but like my, for what, 15 out of 8, or smart, 7, 8, 15 for 23. My math right? 8, 7, and 8. Yeah, that's 23, right? Yeah. 15 for 23 from those guys, eh, you know, so be fine.
Tim on the right.
Welcome to the Athletic NBA Show, Monday through on the Athletic Podcast Network. This is Nerder, She Wrote, with your host, Dave Dufour. With Mo DeKeel.
Are you ready to be entertained?
And Seth Partnow.
Welcome to the Athletic NBA Show. Seth, I think the show's going to come out on Thursday, but I'm Dave DeFore. That person clapping is Mo DeKeel. Seth Partnow's here. That means it's Nerd. She
I'm
wrote.
Pissed. Seth didn't get the clap. He's the one that always claps, but I didn't. He didn't even acknowledge it.
You're supposed to clap before I start talking.
That's fair. Well, I usually wait for him to do it.
I want to point something out, by the way. Speaking of things that always happen, I noticed that last week Dave did not pause between Nerder and She Wrote. And so I was glad to have it back today.
A racy episode. Yeah. I came in too hot last week, man. I was too fired up. I knew Jade was going to put the Dropkick Murphys on there. And the finals, guys. Pretty fun.
Yeah, it has been a very fun finals, I think. I've enjoyed them quite immensely.
People complaining about like some of the blowouts or whatever. Game three was not a blowout.
No,
I mean it was settled toward the end. It was maybe half a blowout, but I thought that it was a pretty back and forth game once the Warriors closed the gap, and then you know obviously Boston just sealed the deal at the end. But I wouldn't call that a blowout.
I mean, I do wonder credit to Boston for responding in the third quarter. But how much of the closeness of the game was a 7-point possession? And that was capped by, you know, Curry hitting a three while getting fouled. It's a tough shot. And then the three that Porter hit after the flagrant, like, it's like, open your eyes, buddy. This all counts, but it was like just sort of a, you know, you're not really counting on a 7-0 run in 20 seconds to make it a close game.
You know what? With the Warriors, Seth, anything's possible, my friend.
That's true.
I mean, maybe not 20 seconds, but a 9-0 run in three possessions is always in play with them in the past. So it's not too wild in that. Now, you know, there's the details of those things, but still, man, it was a fun game. It was a fun game, at least I thought.
I forget who it was, but there was like because of the different ways people are watching it and like the people in the arena were way ahead of the people watching it on cable who are way ahead of the people watching it on streaming. And so someone was saying like, I have like three different timelines, but you know, the Warriors are on a run if all three of them are about Steph.
Right. So, it's about right.
Well, let's jump right in, guys. We were talking pre-show about our show last week after game one. And, we pretty much could just drop the majority of what we said there into here following game three, right? Like, I want to ask the big question up front because, Mo, you were adamant about this last week. You felt like Boston, after one game, had a pretty clear coaching advantage. And of course, one game, small sample, but three games, how do you feel?
I feel even more convicted in that stance and in that sense of just – Ime's pushed the buttons perfectly in this series with his guys. I mean, there's some stuff here and there. We're going to get into some of the strategy stuff where I'm like, huh. And I think everybody can guess that before we get to it. But the ultimate thing is, you know, some of it has been Kerr and the rotations he's doing. Like, I'm not a fan of them going small so quickly and being happy playing small. Like, I'm shocked Kevon Looney played only 17 minutes. In game three, and it wasn't like he was that bad, but it's just a matter of like, yo, they're gonna play small, and I'm like, the other team has the better small ball lineup. The other team has what you were 6-7 years ago, or however long that was. you now need to play big. And I think you can play big against that small lineup. And I just don't think, you know, that Kerr's willing to do it. And I think the thing is, Udoka's, he's going to get out of stuff quickly. And that's something that's usually like a hallmark for me with a lot of coaches. And that's something we're not seeing with Kerr.
And Robert Williams looking better, I think, has allowed Udoka to go away from Daniel Theis completely. I doubt we're going to see him for the rest of the series, right? Like, he didn't play at all, Seth.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think the biggest part of that is, as you say, Robert Williams being healthier. That was definitely both the benefit of Robert Williams being everywhere and not having to have Theis out there, I think really did help them. Like, Theis is a good, solid player, but he does not present the same physicality problems to the Warriors that any of the other guys Boston is using at the five and the four between the Williamses and Horford do. And I think that, you know, in that way, he's very exploitable.
And my thing with Theis, Dave, was I never thought Theis was going to play beyond game two. I felt like it was almost a bullpen game in baseball. Like, let's just get some minutes here to get everybody a little bit more rest. And then, you know, hopefully we won't have to use him. And you're right. I don't think we'll see him again. If he's playing, it's going to be because Williams just can't go for whatever reason.
Yeah, or some garbage time. Is there anything else that stands out to you guys, just kind of general, before we get into actual on-court strategy as far as Udoka goes? Because I actually think his tone has been good with his team. I don't know if you noticed, but body language is great. Some of the practice footage came out from a very loose-looking practice. It feels like the vibes on this team are really good. And it's funny to say that because, 6 months ago, we were talking about the vibes being so awful. And he just flipped this thing around.
It's funny because it's one of those things that the exact same thing, like, is so differently perceived now. Like, I think we can now, having seen him both when they're up and they're down, say that he has a very no-bullshit style. And when they were playing badly, it was like, oh, first year coach lighting his team up in the media. I don't know about that. But instead, he was just like, this is what happened. You know, that's what happened. If you want to take it to that and run with it, I don't care. But, and he's doing the same thing when they're winning now. And I think that sort of steadiness is probably a big part of why they were able to weather playing not well for 2 months at the start of the season and, you know, turn this around.
I mean, it's just his whole demeanor in the sense of, I'm going to just tell you like it is, you know, the timeout or in between quarters in game one, where he's yelling at the guys going like, they're punking you. They are coming at you right now. Is that how you want to go out? Like, not a lot of the coaches are going to say that to their guys in a timeout. And I think there was just, you know, he's constantly challenged them throughout the entire year, even when it was going poorly. So it's kind of a refreshing to see that he stuck to his guns and how he coaches, and he got it. And it's something I've said a long time ago about some coaches of, like, you're going to get fired at some point or at one point or another, so go out your way. And he was willing to do it. And even when people were calling for his head in game, you know, or early in the season, it's now they're praising him. It's a fun turnaround for him, but he never changed.
Yeah, we've seen him say worse than he said on the sideline during any of these games in the post game. Right. I mean, he's called just about every player on that roster soft. I mean, it's very. It's a pop move, right? Like, he's kind of. It's the same. There's no BS. Everyone's gonna get coached, whether they want to or not. But it doesn't seem like anyone's resistant. So, you know, good for Udoka. He looks great, and the series is going well for him.
There is a point to be made about, you know, recent ex players having some credibility here, and, you know, especially someone who is, I imagine you guys have heard the story of like the altercations that when he was with the Nigerian national team, where he would like hold off a whole arena single-handedly and stuff. So someone who can handle themselves, like, probably has a little bit of an ability to say things very matter-of-factly and have it stick. That,
yeah, Paul Bunyan,
a little bit, yeah,
yeah.
But also,
I like it, man.
He's also been around for a long time. When you just look at the fact, like, he came into the league as a 10-day Like, he's literally had to scrap for every little morsel he's had to do, you know, get in the NBA and then work his way through the coaching ranks as an assistant all the way up and, you know, bounced around a little bit and things like that. Like, I think it's interesting in his background and stuff like that. He's literally seen the game through almost every lens as an NBA player. He's going to be able to relate top to bottom on that roster. And I think that's something that goes a long way with his style and his sort of being able to talk to these guys.
Well, let's jump into Boston's strategy here. And I want to start on the defensive end with what's working for them. It seems like the physicality is the key to everything for them. In game two, they didn't have the same sort of force that they had in game one and game three, obviously. What was the difference that you guys saw?
I mean, I think the biggest difference, first of all, I don't think Golden State was nearly as aggressive physically in game three as they were in game two. And I don't think that's surprising for any number of reasons, but it kind of almost like whipsawed back the other way. So that was part of it. And then just having like Robert Williams being much closer to right, like that is a dominant physical presence on the floor that, you know, he's out there, he's kind of there, but his ability to move, to get up for rebounds, to get up for lobs, to get up for blocks, one of which may have been a goaltend, but we won't talk about that. I think that sort of keys a lot of their ability to play with that force is, you know, they have guys who can play with, but if it's, you know, him playing at that level of power and Horford and Smart and, you know, the wings, then all of a sudden that's just a different thing.
Yeah. I mean,
and Jaylen Brown defending like Scottie Pippen doesn't hurt, Mo.
Yeah. But you get to do that when you have an eraser behind you. Right. And I think it all comes back to Robert Williams and their defense. And there are things about his defense that are a little sometimes like him going chasing the block too much sometimes, you know, and leaving a shooter open in the corner or things like that. Those things tend to happen a little bit. But ultimately, I'm with Seth in terms of that side of it. But Brown was awesome. Tatum was great. Like, I really felt like everybody across the board, Derek White struggled a little bit, but you know, everybody else, for the most part, their heavy hitters all played great defensively in this game and all just kind of stepped up to the challenge. It was besides Rob Williams with his big block numbers, it was a big team effort defensively, I thought, with just how they handled things. You know, Seth, you were talking in the our chat, you know, about the Smart switching out to Clay on a pin down and things like that. Like, there's a lot of great things that they're doing really well that they've done all through the year in terms of switching guys out and scram switching and things like that. So I look at what they've done and I just go like, man, this is the Boston Celtics. This is the team we thought, you know, we were seeing and at the end of the season that we were like, yeah, they're probably going to win the championship.
Okay. So they have played a ton of drop on Steph. Like, he's getting a lot of threes that just, we didn't expect them to give up, but then they go away in the fourth. I mean, is it just, they can't maintain switching all game, or do you feel like they're playing too much drop, Mo? I mean, we've talked about this a lot. We talked about it in game one. The pickup points were way too low. You can't let Steph get there. Will they keep doing it? Is that a worry, you think, game four? Like,
I'm terrified.
Surely the role players will hit shots, right?
I'm terrified. Every time they're in drop coverage against Steph, I'm just like, what are you doing? On the infamous 7-point play, you know, Horford's way deep in drop and not at the level of the screen. And part of the reason why he picks up the foul is because he has to run out to Steph. This isn't a third year, 4 year player. This is a dude that's been doing this forever. Like, of all the things, like, they've done everything right. This is the one thing where I look at it going like, you are playing with fire with this. And you've gotten away with it to some respects. Part of it is Clay hasn't shot the ball well until game three. And even then, when he had a shot in game three, there was finally one play where Udoka was going nuts and yelling at Robert Williams for not being up on the screen. But for me, it's kind of funny to me that that's how they're playing it. And I look at it going like, look, to be honest, when we look at the guys they're playing, like, how much offensive firepower is there? Like, why are you playing this and dropping, giving up these shots to Steph? Like, you can knock out, you can take Steph out and make these games a lot easier. You know, I feel like they should be blitzing a little bit more, and they've put two on the ball, but they haven't blitzed, which is the big difference to me.
So I agree that when they have put two on the ball pretty aggressively, it has looked good. I will say, and someone pointed, I think it was the Twitter account Half Court Hoops pointed this out last night, and I thought it was a good observation. It's a lot of the situations where they were sort of caught in drop weren't like the initial action. It would be like a pick and roll and then a hand back. And against like a, you know, guarding, like if Horford was guarding like Otto Porter or something like that. And that's, I mean, you know, that sort of matchup is a little tougher because the guy's just more mobile, can set the screen. And that leads me to my next point, which is there's a little bit of the trade-off they're getting of being caught in those situations. They had like a 40% offensive rebound rate last night. So I asked the question, like, how many Steph threes is that worth to, you know, so, you know, there is a little bit of a, you know, if you are playing two bigs, you're going to get caught in some tough pick and roll matchups against Steph. That's going to happen, but you're making the bet that you win by enough on the other end and, you know, shutting down the paint yourself that it's worth it.
But they weren't playing two bigs a lot in those drops, even in those instances. And their 40% rebound rate, which was freaking absurd, was still when they went small, and we'll get to, you know, and that was also because the Warriors were small. I think the aspect of it, and Half Court Hoops is right in that sense of like it was other actions. But at the start of every action, it was especially Horford, was already inside the three-point line. It doesn't matter. You're done. It doesn't matter if he goes off the first action or the second action, because basically the one player we're talking about where Otto Porter was, he starts slow. He comes off of Porter. White comes over the top, and now all he has to do is beat White over Porter on the rescreen because Horford's so far back, it's daylight, and that's where he gets that look. And I think those are the things with just starting off so far back, it's a massive problem with how they're doing things. And I think that's the stuff I'm like, man, it's just wild to me. It's working, so I'm an idiot and an asshole for bringing it up. But it's like they're winning games, so I can't say anything. But I'm almost like, ah.
Let me ask a question. I'm not sure I believe this. I just like it's worth asking. So the two games where there's been like fourth quarter play of note, I think Steph has tired in the fourth quarter. And is there an aspect of like, okay, yes, he can get, you know, if it's, you know, pick and roll, pitch back, dribble handoff, sprint around, shoot a pull up. Like that's demanding. And so I'm wondering if like, all right, well, if they've got to do all that, okay, do that for four quarters and then, and not gas out. And I just wonder if there's an element of that also, or if that's just sort of a lucky happenstance for Boston, or I'm just completely full of shit.
Well, that's a rope-a-dope, right? Just let him wear himself out so he doesn't have anything at the end. But I actually think it's Rob Williams. I think Rob Williams is the difference. They are owning the paint defensively. The Warriors are not finishing at the rim well. Even on open stuff, they're not. I mean, Robert Williams is really the X factor in this series. I mean, I guess Jaylen Brown is likely, you know, if we care about this, going to win finals MVP. But Rob Williams has been the biggest impact player, I think, the swing piece in the series. And his defense, and especially inside, it has been the big difference maker. Warriors are settling often, I think.
It's not even that. It's you got to watch for him. You know, you got to watch for him. And if he's there, they end up kicking it out. And there have been a couple of games where Curry will go up for a layup and not realize that Rob Williams is coming from the weak side and rejecting the shot and things like that. I think there's a lot of that stuff in terms of the paint. But to Seth's point and question of like how tired, you know, is Curry gassing or whatnot? I think that's definitely a fair assessment. And part of that is because Poole's been so bad. It's not like you've been able to kind of give Curry a lot of rest in that instance. But I also say this, tough shit. It's the finals. It's the finals. It's supposed to be hard, right? Like, this is it. This is the thing. Like, you got to go. And that's the thing. And you got to find that extra gear. And you know, we never let other guys off the hook with being tired. By the way, I think Steph's been spectacular. But like, I think there's an element of like, you know, if he's going to get gassed, he's going to get gassed. But I'd rather him be out there trying with everything he's got. And I think they've gotten hurt in those minutes that he's sat at the end of the third quarter in this one, at the start of the fourth quarter in game one. Like, I feel like those things really have hurt them. And a lot of that is just looking at Jordan Poole going like, dude, you going to do something? Not when we're up 15 or 16?
Well, there's a, you know, You're right. I am not like this is not sort of excuse making for Steph. I'm just like like from a strategic standpoint, like there's been a lot of times where Boston has been sort of okay if Grant Williams ends up on Steph, or if Rob Williams ends up on Steph and stuff like that. And yeah, Steph has gotten some shots off and he's made some shots. He had a pretty tough step back over Grant Williams. But those are like, you know, we've talked a lot this season about hard miles. And those are hard miles on Steph. Like, yeah, he'll get a shot, but he's got to work. And I just like, you know, it's you know, the body blows theory, right? It's the same thing people have done to Luka, frankly, in the playoffs at times. And so I don't know if that's just how it's working out or if there's some intentionality to, all right, he'll have some advantage, but we've got guys who are good enough in those switch that he has to work. And we think if he has to work for four quarters, it's advantage us.
The reason where I think it's a bigger issue, because I don't think it's a problem on offense. This is how the dude plays. Like, this is just what he does. It's the fact that they're able to go at him defensively, and he has to guard defensively, and there's nowhere where he can hide, where he can truly hide on the other end of the court, because they're putting him in everything. Al Horford had two post-ups on him yesterday. I mean, like, there's nowhere he can go.
Marcus Smart was playing
bully ball. Well, that's a perfect two.
Yeah, busted him.
That's a perfect time for me to throw in a break, and we'll talk about Boston's offensive strategy right after this.
I'm Trey Wingo.
And I'm Kevin Frazier. We're teaming up on a new weekly sports podcast from Wondery, Alternate Routes.
As former SportsCenter anchors and current sports obsessives, we're consumed by all the what-if questions that make being a sports fan so excruciatingly fun.
If you're like us, then you also live and die on the fallout from every drop pass, busted draft pick, and game-changing play.
Or play call.
Intercepted at the goal line by Malcolm Butler.
Sorry, Marshawn, still too soon. Each week on Alternate Routes, we'll take a flashpoint in sports, break down what actually happened, then explore every alternate scenario and the ripple effects it would have caused.
Follow and listen to Alternate Routes on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen ad-free by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.
I mean, the possibilities are limitless, Kevin.
What if Portland drafted Michael Jordan?
What if the NBA never vetoed the Chris Paul trade to the Lakers? That's a butterfly effect for
real. This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
From the Mercury News, just what was your reaction to the crowd's chants that were directed to you throughout the game?
They're just talking. It's not really my job to react to them. So they did what I expected.
Marcus, back right.
It's Thompson, the Athletic. Vermont, how do you feel you played?
Like shit.
What was the difference this game?
I just think I never found a rhythm. Really on both ends of the floor. So not enough force, but just got to find a rhythm quicker.
Anthony on the right.
The Athletic. They had 15 offensive rebounds. You guys have protected the glass really well, you know, pretty much all playoffs. What do you think was the issue on the glass?
Yeah, I think that's just a force thing. You know, then once you get comfortable, you establish that presence, then the ball just kind of finds you. You know, you start to get the bounces and the break. So just got to start the game off better.
Fisher, Bleacher Report. Draymond, I'm not saying it's why you struggled tonight by any means, but I found listening to your podcast recaps the last couple of games pretty interesting. Are you conscious at all of what you're saying about the X's and O's, the game plans, the adjustments could be making their way back to Boston staffers and influencing their decision making at all?
No. I don't say much different on the podcast than I say to you right here. So, nah. What's the X and O's that I said on the podcast?
He actually asked. The only real thing I noticed that really stood out, you talked about how to cover White, Smart, and Horford differently between games 1 and 2. That was really only.
Oh, yeah, that was just contested shots. That, if that's X's and O's, then I don't. You reaching for something, it's all good, though. Keep going. reaching heavy. The only thing, you find that they are taking X's and O's away from your podcast. The only thing you said is White, Smart, and Horford.
Okay, guys, let's talk Boston offense. The beginning of these games, it's pretty obvious that they're looking to attack the basket to get that drive and kick game going. The difference, I think, in the game, Jaylen Brown's first quarter in game three, guys, it was just...
That was a problem they're having. So they sort of looked and said, okay, if it's not Andrew Wiggins, none of these guys can stay in front of you, Jaylen Brown. So back it out, everyone else spread out and just like dribble really fast and they can't stay in front of you. And then he did that, and he did that while also being aware of where help was coming from. So he was able to get to the basket and finish or kick, but they made a very intentional effort to give him space and a runway starting like out closer to half court to really attack that, to almost not allow that physicality that worked in game two to come into play.
The more interesting thing, what I found about this game in particular, this one, was they attacked the rim in a way we hadn't seen in the two games. And that was a big thing. And that was, you know, one more thing. It's literally just popped on before we started recording. I got it out. The Celtics in the first two games of the series had 18 shot attempts and fouls at the rim. And these are numbers per cleaning the glass. So I trust them more than anywhere else I can get them. And in game three alone, they had 31. Well, that's just a wild number in that sense. Like, you know, they had 5 in game two. In game three, they had 31. And there was an emphasis. You can tell it was very clear of we're getting to the rim. Everything will start and stop with us getting to the rim. And they were unbelievably relentless in how they did it. From everything you said about Jaylen Brown to Tatum to Smart to like all these dudes just kept driving. And from there, they're able to find the kickouts. It was really impressive. And it was just as impressive as my voice kind of cracking right there.
Well, no, Van Gundy made the point last night that Tatum was like actually going to the basket to score instead of like going near the basket and trying to get fouled. And, you know, probably an area, like one of the areas that he probably still has to improve is his finishing through contact, but he did a much better job of that last night. And that sort of compounds in the fact that when he does those flybys trying to draw a foul, he ends up sprawled on the baseline or waving his arms at the ref and we go the other way. And so that was just happening less because he was extending towards the basket and finishing instead of trying to extend around and flail for a foul.
Yeah, I mean, that's a problem with a lot of these dudes that foul hunt all the time. They go so hard to try to foul hunt, they end up not getting the foul or being any position to make a layup. Like, I think that's kind of the funny thing about the foul hunting. And that's a great point of Tatum. Like, when he does that, big difference.
Figure now is a great time to talk about some of the potential adjustments for the Warriors. Some of these are just really obvious.
Go play – now you can go play the tape from game one.
Really, it just seems – the successes from game two should have been repeatable in game three, right, Mo? I mean, the successes from game two should have been repeatable in game three, right, Mo? I mean, Kevon Looney only played 6 minutes in the second half of game three, and I just can't – even when Draymond fouled out, Andre Iguodala, who hadn't played the entire game, was out there. I was looking for some kind of a report that Kevon Looney was injured.
Yeah, it was weird. And it's, you know, it's at the point now where we're going to have to start looking at you know, Kerr going like, man, what's the fascination with Iguodala at this point? Like, I get it, but at this point, dude's old, you know, and it didn't make a lot of sense. And just to kind of put it out there, in 17 minutes, Looney had 7 rebounds, 3 of them offensive. In a night when you're getting crushed on the boards, that dude needs to be playing 30 minutes. It's not really a debate to me. Like, that dude needs to play. And you want to talk about the offense? Listen, the offense sucks when you play small because they're not guarding everybody. At least Looney in the dunker spot is a threat, if not to get a layup or a dunk, to get an offensive rebound. I feel like they're just kind of leaving that stuff out there, and it's just – I'm watching it going like, man, like this just doesn't make sense to me. And trying to match up with the Celtics small when their small ball lineup is a lot bigger than your small ball lineup, which is what it used to be the other way around, you're kind of falling into the trap here. And I think that's something when I look at Kerr going like, man, if you're not going to play Looney 30 minutes a game, that Warriors have problems.
He also sets the best screens for Steph. And like everything we were talking about earlier about like Steph having to work hard to, you know, work around multiple ball screens. If Looney just plasters a guy and he can step into one, that's like just a much lower effort play for him than having to, you know, sprint around the same screen four times.
Well, and if we could swing the podcast tape back pre-trade deadline, I'm sure we could find a rant from each of us about this Warriors team and their need for what? What sort of depth does this team – I mean, just glaring weakness.
Well, we were pointing it more looking at like, okay, you're gonna run into the Suns in the conference finals. Like just Looney is all you have for Ayton. That could be a problem if you're getting the aggressive version of Ayton. And also looking ahead to the finals, you've got Giannis, you've got Embiid. Okay, they didn't play any of those guys, but Boston's, you know, the size and force Boston's playing with is presenting a similar category, if not the same exact type of problems. And the fact that Looney is their only legit big is hurting them.
I was screaming the same thing with you guys. I also just kind of hindsight now looking at it too. I mean, hell, making a run at trying to get Robert Covington would have helped. You know, just in the sense if you're going to play small, you'll at least have a decent sized small ball lineup in that instance. Like there was it's just a lot of stuff when I'm watching them now. I just think like it's not something they got. I don't think they're I think they just they missed the opportunity there. You know, and I wouldn't have wanted to mortgage the future. I like Kuminga. I think he's going to be really good and fun. But like I would have at least tried to find something somewhere in terms of size that would have just helped. It would have made a big difference right now.
If you're not going to play him right now, then that makes me think that you should have – like this series is kind of – no, this series is kind of, you know, the guy on their roster who has kind of the bounce and physicality that maybe – you know, that Otto Porter doesn't at this point in his career, that Andre Iguodala certainly doesn't at this point in his career, that Nemanja Bjelica doesn't have. Like, it's Kuminga. And like, I'm surprised that he hasn't gotten a look yet. And I'm not sure we will see it because, you know, he's a rookie and blah, blah, blah. But just looking at what they need and looking at their roster.
I mean, honestly, though, like, why not? You need athleticism at this point. Yeah, it's going to hurt, you know, but okay, Moses Moody, something. You need more athleticism on the floor right now. I think this is something I think you have to kind of really start to look at. Now, is it an ideal situation? No, but neither is being down 2-1 in the NBA Finals, right? You're scrambling at this point. You know, I don't feel like when you look at what Jordan Poole has given you in these finals, I don't know if you can just – like this just doesn't seem like a Jordan Poole series to me. You know, and if he's not going to step up when Steph's on the floor, you can't play him with Steph at the same time. You can't play him, Steph, and Clay at the same time. Like you're really kind of running out of options here. You're going to have to give these young guys a shot here, I think. I think that's something you're going to have to give them a few minutes at least and see what happens.
Well, at least they can defend, right? Like Jordan Poole, he's not giving you much on the offensive end, and he just – I mean, he's a turnstile. On the other end, and when Steph was in foul trouble, Steph wasn't much better, you know, and you just can't have that many guys out there that are a target for this Boston offense. I want to talk about Draymond. This was a weird game. The game three, I mean, game two was an all-timer. I thought he was spectacular in game two, and game three, it just wasn't there. He said after the game that he felt like he played soft. And that's funny because there's one play where I swear he fouled Jaylen Brown 6 times. I actually thought he played out of control was the problem. He like went too far, if that makes sense. He's at his best when he's riding that edge between, you know, the fine line where it's fun or mean. I don't know which it is, but I know it's productive. Does that make sense?
And I think that some of that goes down to Boston very consciously, like, giving themselves more space to attack him. So he, like, in game two, so much of what he did was, like, there was action in a tight space, and so he could hit, like, four guys in 2 seconds, and it all kind of be obscured. Where, you know, when Brown is, like, backing out to half court and then getting a running start at him, Draymond can't, like, Jaylen Brown is an elite NBA athlete, and Draymond Green at this point in his career can't stay in front of that if he's got a head of steam. And so they kind of, you know, they changed it from a pure strength game to, at least in that matchup, a speed game. And that, like, you know, the physicality that Draymond wanted to play with, now it's kind of, it's like, you know, the cartoon where, like, the, you know, the giant swings and the Bugs Bunny runs between his legs and stuff like that. That's, it became almost like that.
Yeah. And I think Draymond got caught up in his antics and the noise afterwards of game two. I think the noise afterwards is really kind of what sort of, for 2 days, the story of Draymond and, you know, how he's officiated and I'm so smart. I can get, you know, I know I can, after the first technical, they're not going to throw me out and all of those. I think he got caught up in that. And I think that really kind of had him a little bit flustered. And once things started to kind of go wrong, I think it led to kind of a spiraling out of control. Like, you know, he had a foul. It wasn't even called, but, like, he just threw Jason Tatum out of the way off of a free throw rebound. Like, it was just kind of like, okay, like, this is, it's your guys' wrestling. It was like, this is a WWE type thing or AEW or whatever, QXT or whatever you guys watch. It's along those things. And he just felt like, I just think he got caught up too much in that whole thing. And now, you know, and now it's the narrative of, is this podcast hurting or whatnot? It's all of this stuff. And I think it's he needs to just get back to playing, like, yeah, let's just play basketball.
I do want to ask, just like, if you're Steve Kerr, OK, how do you approach this to pull him back? Because I think that, again, this is the straw that stirs the drink for them. Draymond Green is one of the most important players to the dynasty. I mean, it's him and Steph Curry, I think. And Clay is there, but he's, you know, in the second or third slot. Draymond is super important.
Are you calling Clay Ringo?
I mean, okay, but he's got good rhythm.
Hey, Ringo is my favorite Beatle, so I don't think that's an insult.
All right.
We're talking about Beatles now? Like, what?
Apparently, yeah. but how does Kerr – how do you bring him back, man? Like, because this was clearly – I mean, this was bad. And then I actually didn't love the energy in the post game at all, because it felt very defensive. So, you know, if you're Steve Kerr, what are you guys saying to Draymond to try to bring him back down to earth?
At halftime, one of the players went on a profanity-laced tirade. I did not hear what precipitated it, but he was yelling so loudly that I could hear everything that he was saying. I think that it was Draymond Green. He was yelling and screaming, "I am not a robot.
I 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 am not a robot. I am not a robot."
I mean, if I'm Kerr, I mean, Kerr knows how to handle him better than anybody else in the NBA. There's nothing we're going to come up with any sort of gold here that Kerr doesn't already know. Like, Kerr knows when to chime in and one not to, and all of those things. I just think he just has to either just have a conversation of, like, "Hey man, you good? Like, you good? You okay?"
What if he just played Looney more, right? Like, let's just, no, maybe that one big lineup is Looney and not Draymond.
No, I wanted to play Draymond and Looney together because I think that works for them. I think that works for them when they do that. I think the mistake is, but, you know, Draymond's also got to be under control. And I think that's just got to be the conversation of just like, "Hey man, what's going on?" I think it's something like as simple as that.
We've talked a lot about sort of Draymond's defense and sort of his like approach, and that those are almost side issues to me. The bigger one is what he's not giving them on offense. And this was a little bit like, there was a number of times, like game one, where the ball would find him wide open and he would sprint dribble at the basket and nobody would care. And so all it is burning clock and creating congestion.
And for a while, I was actually surprised by, you know, Boston actually had Tatum on him a lot. And then, like, Tatum was basically, you know, playing the free safety role because, like, well, we don't care what this guy does. So we're going to have our, you know, our athletic, lengthy, smart guy run around and bother everything. And all the other stuff almost doesn't matter if he can't give them something. It doesn't need to be scoring. It just needs to be some kind of a thing that the defense has to react to him. What? Like, there are plays where he gets the ball and, like, he gets the ball wide open in the corner and Marcus Smart is the next guy to close out. And he's not closing out to Draymond. He's closing out to where Draymond is going to hand the ball.
Right.
Like, to the guy who's going to come get a handoff. Not even, like, he's closing out, like, 3 feet to the right of Draymond because he knows that's the only place the threat is.
When this goes back to your you know, theory of Steph kind of running out of gas, well, look at how much he's having to work because Draymond will pick up his dribble. And now all the action has to happen around him. He's not a threat to shoot at all. I mean, they're if Boston forces Draymond to shoot a three, that is a victory.
I mean, every single time. I feel bad for the backboard
and the rim. I mean, it sounds worse than Victor Oladipo's shots, man. Like, the way it hits the rim every time, I feel like something broke in there. It's just, I just don't know what happened to Draymond's offensive game in the last year. Cause it's almost like he's not that interested. He's interested in creating for others, which is awesome, but he's not understanding that he also needs to create, needs to be a threat to score. Cause that way forces the openings to make those passes. It's gotten to the...
Is it a little Ben Simmons-ish?
Oh, a little bit, like, for sure. I think that's definitely part of it, but it's a level of just his hesitancy is really what's hurting them. And so we saw it in the Memphis series a lot. He would catch it in the lane and wouldn't even look to score, would look to try to see if the dump-off pass was there. If not, then he was looking to kick it out when it was like, yo, you need to shoot the floater. It's right there. And he's... I'm fascinated to see or hear what happened to his offense.
All right, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to make some predictions.
Are you struggling to close deals? B2B selling is tougher than ever, and that's why I want to tell you about LinkedIn Sales Navigator. LinkedIn Sales Navigator is a sales intelligence platform that helps professionals effectively prospect and engage high-value customers, drive higher revenue, and increase sales performance. Sales Navigator helps you target the right buyers, surface key signals, and show you hidden allies so that you can find those buyers that are most likely to convert. Fueled by LinkedIn's 1 billion member platform, Sales Navigator gives you the most up-to-date first-party data, enabling you to unlock conversations with people that matter. Right now, you can try LinkedIn Sales Navigator and get a 60-day free trial at linkedin.com/NBAshow23. That's linkedin.com/NBAshow23 for a 60-day free trial. Let LinkedIn Sales Navigator help you sell like a superstar today. Just go to linkedin.com/NBAshow23 and get started.
We just felt that kind of rush of anxiety. I felt like, and it took us a game, two games to really, you know, settle in, you know, to the series and say, okay, this is basketball. You know, we just, you know, we got to play our game and game plan and, you know, execute just like we done in the other series. But this is another level once you go to the finals.
Right. So do you pass that along to a guy like Jordan Poole who's in his first finals and say, yo, it's going to be like that. Just don't trip off of it. Just play through it.
Absolutely. It's my expression to him at the beginning of the year before he kind of, you know, started off on this third year was not too high, not too low. Right? Yes. It's like, man, I have to try to stay even kilter. There's too many games. There's too many emotions. There's a lot of distractions, especially at this time of the year. This is just what this is. This whole machine and this whole game has kind of evolved into. So you have to kind of stay centered as possible.
Okay, guys, we might be finished with the finals before we record again. And it's funny that we're already here, but are we going to go seven, or is this going to be, is it going to be five? Oh, what do you guys think? Who's winning the series now that we've seen three games? Who's going to win the series and how many games, guys?
We should be careful here because we shat on the Warriors this entire podcast. And it's I think it's still kind of silly in that sense. Like, I think their ability to come back. I mean, look at the fact that they did come back and take a lead in this game. And listen, the Celtics went on a run, but some of that was a Marcus Smart three, a Marcus Smart banked three, and things like that. It was a
We don't acknowledge those.
Okay, fine. It was an 8-point game with 7:50 left. The Warriors get a stop, and Andrew Wiggins throws the ball out of bounds when he's trying to hit Steph Curry, who was going to be wide open for a transition three. He knocks that down. It's a 5-point game with 7:50 left. It's a different story now, right? Like, I think we are hammering the Warriors, and at the same time, I'm just going to say, at the very least, I predict the Warriors to win game four. I think this is going to be a 7-game series. I think this thing's still going to go the distance. I think this is going to be a ping pong match in those areas. And I think that's I don't know who's going to win game seven. I picked Warriors in seven, but I think we're going seven. I'll be shocked, Dave, if this thing goes five.
We also have to acknowledge that, you know, for a game they ended up winning comfortably, Boston had two separate periods of that thing they've done all playoffs where they have five possessions of just crazy. And it's not just bad shots. It's bad process. It's bad passes. It's you know, giving up layups the other way. Like, there was a play where, like, Andrew Wiggins just, like picked – Tatum bringing the ball up the floor from behind and ran out for a layup. And that's where these, like, the plays where Tatum flies out of bounds, doesn't get back, and they give up a three or a layup, or they hold the ball at the top of the key for 18 seconds and then get into some nothing. We have to accept at this point that that's who this Boston team is right now. Maybe it's, you know, is it the lack of a pure point guard? I don't know. But they're going to do this. So there's going to be opportunities for Golden State to string together. And Golden State's as good as any team we've seen over the last however long at doing this, string together that 9-0 run in 50 seconds. Like, they're going to have multiple opportunities every game to do that.
Or 7-0 run in one possession. I think we did. We've hammered it pretty hard. But again, I just think, like, there were positive stuff there. Klay getting going in the final three quarters. You know, now whether that's consistent or not, who knows? We haven't had a lot of consistent back-to-back games from Klay. But it's a good sign. I'd rather that than him continuing to suck, which is what he had for the first two games. And I think there were positive flashes of lights. Like, they got some good minutes from Andrew Wiggins in the first half, I thought, you know, and kind of keeping them somewhat in striking distance. Draymond's going to play better. I'm not ready to give up on Draymond in this sense. Like, he's going to play better, especially defensively, I think. I think ultimately they're right in the mix of this. Like, we're going to be – a lot of people are going to write them off because we did the same thing after game one. I think they're right there. I don't think this is going to be a very far spread. And Seth is so – I just can't trust the Celtics offense. They still do enough dumb stuff that, like, I'm like, guys, what are you doing? Like, why are we throwing this away?
And it's dumb stuff that doesn't just take points off the board for them. It puts points on the board the other way.
Every time.
It makes it doubly bit. You said something there about, like, Klay and back-to-back games. I want to talk about Rob Williams and back-to-back games. One game off between, like, we've talked a lot about how him being spring-loaded was a pretty big key to that game. I think there's going to be something I think we're all going to watch very carefully at the start of game four, is if he's moving that well again. And, you know, we're not doctors and we're not in the room, but you have to at least acknowledge.
There you go. Here's the thing. I think he starts out every game looking a little stiff, to be honest with you. It takes him a minute to get loose. I've noticed, but by the end of game three, I mean, he was everywhere at the end of game three. And if he can continue that, and with the short rest, if he comes out of the gate and looks good,
I'll just
I think he's the most important piece out there.
I'm willing to just take a guess that that knee is sore as hell right now.
And again, this game
being just one day rest in between, it's good. I think we'll see something on Friday in terms of that. And it's not a shot at anybody's shirts. That's simple. And,
well,
you know, it's just like
I think the key is that the Warriors need to put pressure on the rim. And if they can get pressure on the rim and make him work a little bit more, especially with the short rest, they can take advantage of the, you know, the advantage that's there. But I just refuse to believe that they're going to do it consistently.
They need to get him in off-ball actions so that he can't rotate over to the rim.
Who pressures the rim on Golden State other than Steph, though?
I mean, when
Wiggins Steph, occasionally. Wiggins occasionally.
Yeah. One, Clay will. You know, like Clay will go in there and he'll try to get a dunk on you or something, like, you know, Wiggins as well and things like that. But it's just, again, this is, it's unfair because Clay hasn't played in 2 years, right? And this is stuff we've been screaming all year. But like, these are the, those are the guys, you know, because it's not Draymond. You know, Looney from the dunker spot could be dangerous. But again, if you're not going to play him, what's the point? It'll be really fascinating to see what Kerr does with his rotations, because I think he's, I think he's got to play Looney more, and I think he's got to give the young kids a little bit of a run here just for the athleticism.
Yeah, I think the series is going to go seven. I think it's going to go seven, and it's a toss-up then. But, Seth, are you feeling the same? Or
you may have noticed I didn't make a prediction, and I'll keep it.
Yeah, no. I hate predictions, too. Yeah, it feels like, it just feels like this is even. Dry, though.
Thank you. Great teammate.
It's such a close series. And the entire time with Boston, the thing that I come back to is how much do we trust them to trust their offense? Right?
I mean,
this is the story of the Boston Celtics. So if they'll trust their offense and continue to get into stuff fast and not make the dumb mistakes that they tend to make on offense when things aren't going well, or when things are going too well for them and they slow things down.
Or
they can win it in six.
Or they throw crazy alley-oops when they could, like.
Oh, I love that. If Jaylen Brown had gotten to that alley-oop, it would have been one of the highlights of the NBA Finals of all time. It would have been amazing.
I almost, for hubris purposes, was like, now the Warriors have to win. Hubris.
All right, we're getting off the rails. All right, time to wrap it up. That's going to do it for this week, folks. For Seth Partnow and Mota Keel, I'm Dave DeFore. This has been Nerder. She wrote. On the Athletic NBA Show. Thanks for listening.
Go watch one more thing.
Please go watch one more thing.